morning, everyone. This is Sunday, October 25th, 2015. Our subject today is probation after death. We had a good Bible study yesterday. I'm going to ask if anyone has any questions or anything they'd like to say or add. Okay, I guess not. All right, then. One thing I wanted to start with before we go into science and health is Isaiah 28:10. Who has it that they can read it? It's citation 3 in the Bible.
Well, precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little and there a little.
Thank you. So what does that mean to you all?
Well, you have to build on the basis, and you can't expect to just get there right away. It's little steps here and there, and not to get discouraged, but to continue. And yeah, that's what it means to me.
Thank you. Anybody else?
It in the lesson, it follows 2 Corinthians, behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation. But to me, this told me a little bit about what salvation is. Salvation is not crossing the finishing line and being perfect in every way. Salvation is a process of learning more about God, getting closer to God, and living a more God-like life. And now is the time to start. Precept number one. And then be ready for eternity. Every day will precept for us. That should be something to look forward to.
That's wonderful.
Thank you.
I've often thought that the traditional Christian church of heaven, you know, idea of heaven is the final, ultimate destination. Well, there is no ultimate destination. It's a process, like Gary was just saying. That is the heaven. It's the working, not the finally getting there and sit down and relax.
Yeah, this is such a wonderful concept Mrs. Eddy gives us. And we have every day to work it out. And it goes along with in Science and Health, where Mrs. Eddy says, and also in citation 3, every day makes its demands upon us for higher proofs rather than professions of Christian science. These proofs consist solely in the destruction of sin, sickness, and death by the power of spirit as Jesus destroyed them. And then, this is an element of progress, and progress is the law of God, whose law demands of us only what we certainly can fulfill. So each day you have an opportunity, moment by moment, to either be demonstrating this truth, living it, getting yourself closer to God, or turning away from it, or trying to wait for some ultimate thing to happen eventually, maybe not so ultimate.
I think that where it reads, until the goal of goodness is assiduously earned and won, may seem like a destination, but it's more of gaining a realization, you know, more being more sure of who we are because we've learned so much more about what God means and what God means, therefore, what we are.
Yes, thank you. So take the challenge and live it and love doing it and don't put off what can be done today. And be aware of your thinking. Ask yourself, where am I? What am I thinking right now? Is it in accord with God? Am I making some progress or am I seeming to go backwards with negative thinking? Lawrence, was there anything you particularly wanted to talk about today?
Well, I think I was thinking about what I realized, which was rather surprising to me since studying Christian Science. It's about pride. And I think before Christian Science, I thought, you know, like that kind of humility where you don't, it's almost like you don't feel like you're worth anything. It's just being humble. But I read somewhere, I can't remember, and I've been trying to find this site, you know, where the passage or whatever, that, you know, going through life feeling that you don't deserve forgiveness for certain things, and in other words, just refusing to forgive yourself or get out of self-condemnation and stuff like that, it's really a sense of pride that is, I think it was described, meanest sense of pride or something.
Yes.
Am I correct? Because I know I read it somewhere. And it was...
Yeah, you're right. It's the worst form. It's the worst form of pride.
It's self-deprecation is the worst form of pride, Mrs. Eddy says.
Yeah.
And that's putting yourself down. And maybe it sounds humble, but when you put yourself down, who are you putting down?
God.
Yeah.
It's interesting that it's not all the, you know, the just the pompous and the wearing those clothes. That's the only, not the only sense of pride, but that one can be too, which is surprising. Was surprising to me, but it makes perfect sense.
Yes. So what would be some examples of that?
It's like not forgiving yourself. I mean, God says when you stop doing certain things, it's, you know, you're forgiven. Just move on and, you know, really get to know who you really are. Instead of that, oh, no, this was too bad. I can't, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, no, I can't forgive myself. No, it's, you know, it's just awful. And you live not happy and chastising yourself the whole time. Why? When God has forgiven you.
You're so immersed in personal sense.
Yeah, definitely always in personal sense, the wrong sense of yourself.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've been there a few times where somebody pointed it out. It's really stubborn will that you don't get back up on your feet and do the right thing and carry on and go forward from here. And you get putting on this false sense of humility. Somebody described it to me as being so proud of your humility. Contradiction of terms, you know, which means there's no humility at all. It's nothing more than stubborn human will.
It often comes in the guise of keeping you from progressing. You know, my mother, and I used to think she was so humble, but it took me a while to get wise to this, but she would say things like, oh, so-and-so is so much better at something than I am. Well, that's the same kind of false humility. And maybe by saying that, it means that you don't have to do it because so-and-so will do it. Or even, you know, so-and-so has so much more faith than I do, or so-and-so has, you know, more accomplishments in some ways. All of those things. Look at the root of that. Is God saying that to you? That's a false sense of who and what you are. And it is. It ends up in a way of being a backward sense of pride.
And it can also be envy.
It can.
Which is an evil passion.
Also disobedient to the Isaiah that we talked about earlier, precept upon precept. Oh, somebody else is so much better than me, so I'm not going to take the next step in this precept process.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Why not?
It would keep you immobilized or keep you backing down. I mean, and I used to do it too. I did it. You know, it's what my excuse for not doing things, because other people were better at it than I was. And it was an excuse. Like I couldn't possibly give a testimony because I just couldn't do that. Right.
Yes.
Everyone else does so well, or you know, I can't speak at the round table, or I can't write on the form because everyone else does it so much better than I. Well, you just hide behind that excuse. And it looks like a very, maybe humble excuse, but it's a very bad excuse. Once you put it in the light of day and let's take a look at it.
Is it the same idea as not being worthy, having a sense of not being worthy?
Exactly what it is.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And then look at how it has become institutionalized in the world. How many churches tell you, well, you were born a sinner. You know, you were born into sin. So you've got this, you know, albatross around your neck. So good luck.
Yes.
So what does that do to people? Well, I mean, I see a lot of people who really believe that they were born a sinner, that, you know, maybe there's hope, maybe there's not. So, you know, so what the heck? Let's just keep on sinning. I mean, you know, let's make a party out of it. Or you know, and then they crash and they get so depressed and they have no place to turn because they don't have the hope of their true identity.
That's a huge misconception, because when I've seen the youngest of children, they are the best examples of purity I've ever seen. Who's going to say they were born a sinner? Come on, what a contradiction.
Exactly. And if you have all these sins, you don't want to try because it's like useless. You'll never get out because you're so deep in the hole. Yes.
But deep down, it's an excuse.
Right. It ends up being an excuse.
It's a lousy excuse.
To hide behind. And these are the seeds of the old theology. And that Mrs. Eddy exposes to destroy. And we all have them because, you know, we've all been, well, it seems to come down through generations, these false beliefs, and they have to be exposed and destroyed. And thank God that Mrs. Eddy does that. And along that line, Elizabeth, your blog on, well, the veil, right? What I thought that was so interesting. You too, right? Yeah. Can you either read it or tell us?
Remember it, Elizabeth?
Yeah, I have it. If I can get my computer going here. It was one of the Bible commentaries. And let's see here. Okay. It was the citation, Isaiah 25:7, and he will destroy in this mountain the face of the covering cast over all people and the veil that is spread over all nations. And one of the Bible commentaries, it was by John Gill, who lived from 1697 to 1771, he said, and he will destroy in this mountain the face of the covering cast over all people, or the covering of the face, that which has covered the face of all people, that darkness which has been spread over them, partly by Muhammad and his Alcoran, and partly by the Pope of Rome and his party. The covering of human doctrines and traditions seems chiefly intended, which now will be removed, as well as all pagan and Mahometan darkness, through the clear ministration of the everlasting gospel, which will be spread with power and in its purity throughout the whole world. And I just thought that was interesting that he mentioned all those things that we've also talked about.
Yeah, at that time, before Mrs. Eddy, it's very interesting. But here again, this is the old theology, the old beliefs. And now some maybe perhaps new beliefs, but beliefs nonetheless. Sometimes when people ask about, you know, why they haven't had their healing, they're trying so hard, it's usually they're still involved in a belief system that's not the truth about God and man. And they've done it so long they don't even realize they've done it. And Mrs. Eddy sets man free from those belief systems. And in the lesson in Science and Health, where she says, heaven is not a locality, but a divine state of mind in which all the manifestations of mind are harmonious and immortal, because sin is not there. And man is found having no righteousness of his own, but in possession of the mind of the Lord, as the scripture says. Now, how does this relate to what we've just been talking about pride and self-deprecation?
If you have the mind of the Lord, you've given up all material sense and beliefs, and you don't have anything of your own. You are one with God, and you love God, and He's your all.
Yes.
Paul said, let us run the race that is set before us. Each one of us has a life before us to live and a purpose to live. That's what the race is all about. And it's not like heaven is a place where you can go to and not have to make the progress. Heaven is the process of making progress.
And the point being, you make the progress when you know you've got the mind of Christ, that this isn't all about you, and whether you can do it or you can't do it, or whether you're so great or whether you're so terrible. Neither is the truth when you have this mind of Christ and you put off the old man for the new. And this is a spiritualization process that does go on. And this is what is required of each and every one of us. And it is, I'm going to read later something from Lessons of the Seventh Day, but it is what Mrs. Eddy based her hopes of a church on, spiritualization of mankind and man's ability to have this spiritual sense to discern between the false and the true.
And humility is knowing that you have no mind other than God, knowing it.
Accepting.
Exactly. And that's what true humility is. Pride, on the other hand, belief that there is a mind other than God that can be better than God or worse than God or, you know, really good or really terrible. That pride is what causes people to trip and fall. And not make progress. Sometimes even go backwards.
Anyone else on this? And now go ahead, Mike.
I think everybody's life is a parable and could be written about in a future Bible, so to speak. And thinking back on Mary's testimony on Wednesday. I thought that was just such a wonderful, humble thing to present, and it gives me such hope that I too can work my way through things that I need to work through.
Well, thank you, and that's what the testimony should be, because humble so that you can help other people, and when you've really been through something, you can, and you will have no pride about it. You know it wasn't you. You've gotten over it, and you see it for what it is. It's only when you're still prideful about it that you can't tell anybody about it. So to me, that's an indication if you've really gotten over it or not. When you can speak about it freely and know it was never true about you, and you've come over it, and you're stronger for it, and you did it, others can do it too. So now that Jeremy's with us, he can tell us the story of the wolves.
Oh, okay. you just want me to read it?
Yeah, you can read it.
Okay, I don't have the one from the newsletter. I just have the one from the forum.
Okay.
Okay.
One evening, an elderly Cherokee brave told his grandson about a battle that goes on inside people. He said, "My son, the battle is between two wolves inside us all. One is evil. It is anger, envy, jealousy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, and ego. The other is good. It is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith." The grandson thought about it for a minute and then asked his grandfather, "Which wolf wins?" The old Cherokee simply replied, "The one you feed."
So, even the Cherokees understood this principle, even, I say, a specialist, or of course.
And why not? It's universal.
Why not? Absolutely. We have no monopoly on anything. So anyway, I thought that was it's such a beautiful story. We did have it in the newsletter a few years ago. I think Shahida had originally found it. I'd never heard it before. Anyway, it's one to think about, and that's what you ask yourself during the day. What am I feeding? Am I getting all down and depressed on things, myself, situations, or am I emphasizing the good, looking for the good, praising God, keeping my thought lifted? Because think of it, if you think of feeding it, what's going to happen when you feed it?
It'll grow.
Right. You don't want to have some monster on your hands. It's never the truth, whether it's a monster or a little tiny nothing, but it's never the truth. But that story that about in a Sunday school, a little boy asked the teacher, "Why didn't they destroy
a little snake when it was a little snake?"
Yeah.
Instead of waiting for it to become a big red dragon.
Right. And that is so true. Do any of you want to speak to that?
That's really true. That is so true. Oftentimes we just push things off and say, "Oh, it's not so bad. You know, why should I get into that?" And then it gets unbelievable and uncontrollable, and then we have to really sit down and call you and discuss how one can work it. With a little problem, of course, one just wanted it all, and that was the moment to really, you know, look it in the face and say, "Go." But of course, that would be too simple.
Or, you know, you keep pushing it, and then it out pictures on the body in some form. And then you really have to look at it, and then it's become a monster. You know, it's more frightening and less, you know, you seem to be less able to see its unreality, because here it is staring in your face. So.
Yes. Exactly. It gets more real. It's still this bad dream you're having, but it seems more real. Carol, you spoke to it on the forum, too.
Yeah, the precept upon precept, it made me think that as the little things come up during the day, a little negative thought, a little inconvenience, whatever, we need to handle that right away, because otherwise, a day, a month, a year later, we're going to have something big to take care of. And that's exactly the same thing you were just saying. It's if we handle it while it's small, it's easy to handle when it's small. But we just have to be awake and be consistent, be awake to it, and do it every time. And then we grow.
Yeah, and it doesn't manifest itself as some other problem that seems bigger. It's still that little seed of whatever, disturbance, hate, annoyance, greed. You've just been feeding it, so you've got something that looks a little bigger. So these are tremendous lessons, and it all goes along with probation after death, because this is what it's all about. And this is why, too, it's important at the end of your day to go through your thought and see, have you let seeds of discontent, discouragement, all of these things that Jeremy just listed, have you let them go unhandled? And if you have, you make sure you don't before you turn out the light. You clear your slate of it. Get your peace. Know their unreality. Sometimes it's a struggle. But if you don't, chances are your night won't be too restful. And you'll wake up in the morning with the same pile of problems, and they will have grown.
So ultimately, we're dealing with thought, aren't we? What are you allowing to stay in your thought? I mean, a lot of stuff will come to you to the door of your thinking every day. You can't help that. But what you can help is whether you turn it away or let it stay there.
And it, as you become more aware of what you're thinking, you will find it always does come first as a suggestion. For instance, you just don't wake up one morning and say, I'm going to divorce my husband. No, you've been thinking about that for a while. it's been there. Or really, you don't wake up one morning and just say, oh my gosh, I'm just so depressed. That doesn't happen. I used to think, oh, it just happened. I had no control over it. You go back and you think of the thoughts you've been thinking. They've been very depressed thoughts. So these things don't just happen. There is this falling away first. So, Jeremy, now what were the workings of animal magnetism? He's well prepared.
I've been caught before.
He brought his homework.
Well, the first stage is stupidity, idiocy, or frenzy, suffering, or exhilaration, unconscious of the error he says or does. The second stage is, when told of it, will deny having said or done the wrong and argue in defense of it. And the third stage is, will declare that there is no animal magnetism.
And I have heard that one from so-called very good, kind of choke on that word, Christian Science workers. Say it's nothing, so don't bother yourself with it. Okay, the first one, stupidity.
Well, I guess I can think of this because once in a while a situation will come up and I completely blank about like what to do about it. You know, I just like there's nothing there to combat the, you know, materially what it looks like. So.
Well, I think stupidity is not paying any attention to your spiritual sense. You're in a situation, you hear someone say something, you see somebody do something, and if your spiritual antenna is not up, you're going to be stupid as can be and a sitting duck. But if your spiritual sense is in tune, and you're listening with your heart, God will warn you of things to be concerned about, and he will lead you in the direction of things that he are good for you to go in, and he will give you whatever it is that you need to do about situations that you're in.
Stupidity is a characteristic of the human mind. Anyone in the human mind is going to be extremely stupid. And I don't care how many years of schools they've been to or what schools they've been to, they will do very, very stupid things. I mean, we see it everywhere. You see it in the government. They have no, as Gary just said, spiritual sense.
And I've seen very intelligent people, once they're in that human mind, they just don't know what they're doing. And the human mind, I mean, another characteristic, and you can say it for yourself, you start to feel dull, don't you? And apathetic. And you can do stupid things. Usually, because you're doing something stupid, hopefully it'll wake you up. So you stop it. I was somewhat amused because I've heard Rosalind's grandchildren have said, you know, the word stupid, it's not allowed in the classroom. You can't say stupid. You don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. But, hey, come on. And here again, we disown it. If you go around thinking that you're stupid, that's that self-deprecation we were talking about. If you're in the wrong mind, you're stupid, so get out of the wrong mind and you'll be the most intelligent, wise person ever could be. So watch out if you feel dull. The word apathy, apathetic, that's part of the dullness and the stupidity. You just don't care anymore. You just, you know, you're so easily, what?
Led astray,
mesmerized. You know, watching, pardon me?
Hoodwinked,
yes.
Right.
Yep.
Blinded.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, some of these ridiculous scams, they're playing on people's stupidity. I mean, if someone calls you and asks you, you know, for your Social Security and tells you they want you to give them $1 million and they'll do whatever. I mean, you know, how stupid can you be? You don't do those things. But if you're taken off guard, not watching, not alert, you will get into it. It's the workings of abnormal magnetism. So what's another one?
Idiocy.
Okay, well, that's
kind of right up there with stupidity.
Yeah. Then you get really bad, I guess. Moral idiocy.
Seems more chronic stupidity.
Yeah, right. And you don't even know you're stupid. You're just in a mode of moral idiocy, yes. Your conscience is no longer working. You're plowing through.
Idiocy is when you start doing things that you would never do if you were in your right mind.
Yeah. Okay.
And frenzy.
Yeah.
Months ago, you had mentioned these, and frenzy was the one that stuck out to me, because that's certainly how I always felt before, like, just at my wit's end, and, you know, I was just barely keeping up with everything, and I just rushing around and trying to finish stuff.
Well, and what about a big parade or a political gathering? You know, someone gets up there and gives a speech, how you gotta oppose this, you gotta stand for this, you gotta do this, you gotta do that. People get all worked up, don't they?
Rock concert?
When Apple releases a new product.
Yeah, when people head for the store and they stand in line for hours, right?
Walmart opens at, you know.
We have Black Friday coming up.
Black Friday.
Yeah.
The shopping frenzy.
Yeah. Well, and any time, or even if you hear some disturbing news, and oh, you're running all around, and you've got to do this and do that. And, oh my gosh, you know what's going on, and you just get frenzied. You start flying around. I used to love that. I Love Lucy when Desi heard that. You know, Lucy was about to have a baby, you know, and beforehand they'd be practicing, he'd pack his suitcase, he'd go around doing everything, and then when the news came that she had to go to the hospital, he was berserk. I mean, it made fun of it, but it was a case in point. Keep your cool, keep your calm, not be frenzied, because you know darn well once you get in that frenzy, you're going to do a stupid, idiotic thing. Workings of animal magnetism.
But isn't that what you know, like Christmas has turned into?
Yeah.
A shopping frenzy. It's totally lost its original meaning.
Yeah. Yep.
The human mind has taken over and turned it into a shopping frenzy.
And other frenzies, too. You know, your parties and all the pressures and Thanksgiving could be that if you don't stop it. Someone going to say something?
No, I was going to say Thanksgiving, because all of these holidays have become frenzied, really.
Yeah.
Running around, gotta get this, gotta get that. Oh, it's finished in the store, it's finished in that store, you know, that kind of state of thought.
Yes.
But Christmas is really the worst, I think.
Yeah.
Because you have to, you know, people feel like they have to get all these presents and decorations, you know.
Right. And remember, you do not have to do anything that God doesn't tell you to do. And in The Next Liberator, Carol found a beautiful story in Precepts, and you want to just briefly...
You know, it was, I guess he was a teacher or a practitioner of Christian Science in Mrs. Eddy's time, and he, for a Christmas gift, he prayed and sent out a feeling of peace and joy to every one of his students, and they felt it, they got it. And it was said that that's the best kind of Christmas gift anyone could ever have had, and that was what Mrs. Eddy did as well. And she was so pleased to hear that he had done that.
Yes,
and it's a beautiful article.
It is. It is. And if you are so wound up in all the gift-giving and, quote, merriment, you don't have that peaceful state of thought to do that. And this is truly what we should be doing in our watching as well. You know, sending out this sense of love and peace and joy to all mankind. And destroying any arrow that's lurking, knowing it's nothingness. So this is our work, and this is what we must watch for. And wouldn't it be animal magnetism to flip things upside down?
And to the extent that we don't do it in this lifetime, before we pass from this experience to the next one, we're just going to have to do it later. And that's what the lesson's about. I mean, these are when error comes to us, it's a test. What probation is, testing time. If we don't pass the tests before we leave, well, we'll just have to pass them afterwards.
Yeah, and this is what. So, what is the second death? Well, what's the first death?
Earth into matter.
The belief,
okay.
That you were born a material thing.
And that you die out. That's the first death. But, as Gary just said, that doesn't mean all your beliefs have left you. So the second death is when you finally have graduated to realizing your beliefs and the utter unreality of them. And we might as well start right here and right now doing this. It doesn't get better if we postpone it. Any more of the workings of animal magnetism?
Can I say something?
Sure.
On the frenzy, if you get angry, to me that's a frenzy too, because you get all upset.
Yes.
You say things that maybe you don't mean, or to me that's a part of being in the frenzy.
Absolutely. Good point. Yes. Anger. Frenzy. You say terrible things, and sometimes it's very hard to take those things back when you say cruel things to people. They have to work to get rid of it. No, it's not true. If they can, if they know something about the truth, they can, but not a good thing. What was the other, exhilaration?
Suffering or exhilaration.
Okay. Suffering and or exhilaration. Well, I think the suffering is, you know, when you get in too much into your suffering and think you're a martyr. I mean, suffering can come, but it should come only to be healed and to step out of it, not to stay in it and wallow in it. It's all your self-deprecation.
you know, identify with it.
Right. Or think it's a huge badge of merit. I mean, it's neither one nor the other, to be overcome and healed.
And but if you indulge in the first part of this, you know, the frenzy or whatever, if you indulge it, you will suffer. That is how sin is destroyed.
I have a question. Can I ask it, please?
Of course.
I wanted to know, what is a perfect Christian Science Christmas?
Whatever God directs you to do.
And that would be true for Thanksgiving, all the holidays?
Yeah, Mrs. Eddy says it's a feast of soul and a famine from sense. You read, study, and we do. We all should start. We were always taught here at the right after Thanksgiving to start reading her articles on Christmas. They will guide you as to what a perfect Christmas is. But it's more soul and less sense. And no one can tell you. Each one has an individual, but it should be growing out of some of these material festivities.
And your perfect Christmas will be different from somebody else's perfect Christmas because you're an individual.
You have to demonstrate from your standpoint.
And another thing that might be helpful, there's an article by Mary Baker Eddy called Thanksgiving. She goes on to describe this family settings, everybody's so happy together, the old people, the young people, and in the very next sentence she says, and what about those that don't have a home to go to? So,
thank you.
The holidays are not to get into yourself and how wonderful my family is.
Very, very important.
And I ask, where does she say that? I would like to read it.
You look in Miss Laney's writings and look up.
Okay. Thank you.
Titled Thanksgiving.
I got it. Thank you.
And she did that about Christmas, too. She says, and what about those who, you know, the hearth is empty or loved one is gone? She was always thinking of others. And, you know, Andrew used to talk about how depressed he would be going to the Thanksgiving services at Christian Science churches because everyone got up and talked about my family and how great things were for them, and he'd leave very depressed. So that must never, ever be.
Before he got to Plainfield.
Yes, before he got to Plainfield. And here we always reach out to everyone, and that is a major point. And that's also the major point of praying for others, as Carol brought out, and sending a blessing. There's one more thing, and we won't have time to get into it. I do want to do one question in miscellaneous writing. But in the lesson, it's citation 5, and I want you to be thinking about this. The supposition that sin is pardoned while unforsaken, that happiness can be genuine in the midst of sin, that the so-called death of the body frees from sin, and that God's pardon is aught but the destruction of sin, these are grave mistakes. What's a grave mistake?
Deadly.
Yes. Thank you. That's just the answer I wanted. Deadly. So, you go over those. Do you believe any of those things? Do you think that they're true in any way? You make sure you don't. They're very important points. And they are deadly mistakes. And a lot of them, I think, are perhaps, you know, they're taught. Maybe in old theology, maybe in the school systems, I don't know, but make sure you understand they're deadly mistakes. Don't make them.
So in the zeal to forgive, we must know that error cannot be excused. There's no excuse for it.
Yes.
Crime is inexcusable.
Thank you.
So in society where it seems like people get away with things or want to get away with things, or encouraged to give them another chance so they can get away with it again. That doesn't happen.
doesn't do anybody any good.
No.
No.
It's not progress, it's regress.
And it's a fatal mistake. Deadly.
It is deadly.
Yes.
It's like what one addict was saying. This was kind of sad. He said, why, how can I want more than anything what is destroying my life?
Wow.
It is, yeah. And yet he still believed that that's what, if he got the next fix or whatever they call it, it made him feel warm and loved. And it's just crazy.
And his real need is for God.
God.
You know, it fills all voids. And just as that story Elsie gave a few weeks ago of that addict who had that dream and it changed his life, one of a God-filled life, so it can be for everyone, everywhere. God fills that void. And this is the work we have to do daily, not just for ourselves, for everyone, everywhere. So on page 38 of Miscellaneous Writing, line 13, we have a question and an answer. Who would like to read it?
I can.
Okay. Thank you.
How happened you to establish a college to instruct in metaphysics when other institutions find little interest in such a dry and abstract subject? Metaphysics, as taught by me at the Massachusetts Metaphysical College, is far from dry and abstract. It is a science that has the animus of truth. Its practical application to benefit the race, heal the sick, enlighten and reform the sinner, makes divine metaphysics needful, indispensable. Teaching metaphysics at other colleges means, mainly, elaborating a man-made theory or some speculative view too vapory and hypothetical for questions of practical import.
Isn't that wonderful? the nerve of this person. But this is what we're handling. This is what you need to handle in your watch, that this science is just too dry and no one would want it. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And she so well answered it and then just turned it back on all the human theories. The human theories are dry. No one wants to talk about it. That's true. But not science. So remember this. And in your watches, I keep thinking, well, we'll skip a question, but there's always so much good in each question. Because this is the thought that needs to be destroyed, that it's dry, no one will be interested in it. Well, that's a stupid on the questioner's part, because he knows nothing of it. And so he could think that, but it's not the truth. And we have come to awaken all mankind to the truth. So today I'm going to read just a little bit from Lessons of the Seventh Day, just to make you all think. I know that most of you have been studying Discerning the Rights of Man by Richard Oakes, in which he talks about the struggle to get the Carpenter books out. And there was a man called Dittemore who was very much involved in it all. He'd been the clerk, and he was the one who had all her letters, who kept everything, and was even, you know, he was going to sell them, and Carpenter finally did get copies of it. And eventually Dittemore realized at the very end, after reading Carpenter's biography of Mrs. Eddy, that he probably made a very brave mistake. Actually, it could have been, but it wasn't a grave mistake. But anyway, this is how he came into being. According to William Lyman Johnson and other writers, Archibald McClellan, who had never thought highly of William Lyman Johnson or his son, they felt the church needed a clerk who was not blandly dependent on guidance from Mrs. Eddy, i.e. a clerk who might be counted on to support McClellan's own ambitions. He began suggesting to Mrs. Eddy that a change was necessary, and the replacement he recommended was naturally one of his former Chicago buddies, John B. Dittemore. an efficient and experienced businessman. At the third attempt, Mrs. Eddy acquiesced, quite aware of the lesson God was preparing for those who would learn in no other way. She even agreed to Dittemore as the replacement, but added prophetically, quote, "If you want him, take him, and all that goes with him." This was part of the storm that was developing while she was still here. And it also goes on to say that Dittemore was one who turned against Edward Kimball, the man who had virtually sponsored them. And then later, you know, when it came up about the estoppel clauses, Mr. McClellan was, he was saying, how is the board going to get around the estoppel clauses in the manual? The reply was now inevitable and simple. How can we get the consent of a dead woman? So the answer was that the law does not require the impossible. So we know that they totally ignored the estoppel clauses. This was the working of the human mind taking over, thinking they knew more than Mrs. Eddy, making the decisions in the human mind, stupidity, there you go, idiocy, all of this stuff in operation of the human mind. Mrs. Eddy knew what was going to happen. She had to let it happen, and it has happened. And we thank God for those who stood, like the Carpenters and Oaks and many others, and that's why we have here what we have now. Thank God for that. But it's important to know this history and also to see the danger of drifting into that mind that doesn't really know what it's doing, although it thinks it does. So with that, we will go forward and have a wonderful service, God-filled. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.